shining, somewhere the songbirds dwell. Hushed in thy sad repining, God lives and all is well. Somewhere beautiful, beautiful Lyle, beautiful Isle of somewhere. Land of the true, where we live anew. Beautiful Isle of somewhere. Somewhere the load is lifted, close by an open gate. Somewhere the clouds are rifted, somewhere the angels wait. Somewhere beautiful, beautiful Lyle, beautiful Isle of somewhere. Land of the true, where we live anew.
Two of the greatest possessions man can have are grace and peace. Grace is the favor we get from God, which is not earned or deserved, the free gifts from God. Peace is that state in which we have no conflicts with ourself, with our fellow man, or with our God. In 2 Peter 1, verse 2, we learn, "Grace and peace be multiplied unto you through the knowledge of God and of Jesus our Lord." Since it is through the knowledge of God and Jesus Christ that we have grace and peace, how important it is for us to learn about God. Please join us at this time as we search the Scriptures to increase our knowledge of God and of Jesus our Lord. Each of these lessons is available free on cassette tape. For your free copy of any of these lessons presented on this program, please contact me, Dr. N.C. Crouch, Hamilton, Texas.
Sing me a song about Jesus, sing me a song about His love. Sing with all your might, every day and night, make the hallelujahs roll. Sing out the blessed old story, tell how He gave the victory. Dying on a tree, all for you and me, how He came and made me whole.
Sing me a song about Jesus.
About Jesus.
Sing me a song about His love.
About His love.
Sing with all your might.
Sing it.
Every day and night.
Sing it. If the way is bright or dim.
Sing me a song about Jesus.
About Jesus.
Sing me a song about His love.
About His love. Sing about His grace. Till you see His face. Sing me a song about Him. Jesus, the wonderful Savior, guides me along the rugged way. Never lets me fall. Hears my feeble call. Makes the way so bright for me. I will forever adore Him. I will forever sing His praise. He will take me home. Never more to roam. Then His loving face I'll see.
Sing me a song about Jesus.
About Jesus.
Sing me a song about His love.
About His love.
Sing with all your might.
Sing it.
Every day and night.
Sing it. If the way is bright or dim.
Sing me a song about Jesus.
About Jesus.
Sing me a song about His love.
About His love. Sing about His grace. Till you see His face. Sing me a song about Him. Sing me a song about Him.
We're continuing in the 19th chapter of the book of Acts. We're at the 26th verse, and in this portion of the study, Luke is telling the story of the work of the Apostle Paul in the city of Ephesus. Ephesus was the home of the temple of the goddess of Diana, which was one of the seven wonders of the world. And the Apostle Paul had been teaching that there are no gods that are made with hands. And as a result of this, the silversmiths, the ones who were involved in the making of these little idols, these little images, and the ones involved in making the shrines or the small replicas of the temple of the goddess of Diana and selling these things for a living and making good money at it, they had now gotten disturbed about this doctrine that Paul was teaching. So they'd come together in this city of Ephesus. They're having a big meeting. It's kind of a mob meeting they're having here. And the man who is the chief among them, named Demetrius, who hired a lot of these craftsmen to work for him, he came together with his hired people, along with other workmen of like occupation. And he said in verse 25, "Sirs, you know how that by this craft we have our wealth. Moreover, you see and hear that not alone at Ephesus, but almost throughout all Asia, this Paul hath persuaded and turned away much people, saying that there be no gods which are made with hands." So he is putting the problem out before the people like he sees it. The fault of all of our financial problems has to lay upon this man, Paul. He's the one that's going around teaching that there be no gods which are made with hands. And, of course, we have to realize that that is a true doctrine, that there be no gods which are made with hands. It was taught in the Old Testament. It's taught in the New Testament. If the Apostle Paul were here today teaching us today, he'd be teaching this very same thing. And we have to be most careful that we not allow ourselves to put any kind of spiritual value, to put any kind of religious emphasis on any of these little things that are made by hands. We can't take a replica of anything, whether it be a replica of a being in heaven, or whether it be a replica of something here upon this earth, whether it be a replica of even the cross. We can't take any of those things and use them for any kind of religious purposes, to have any kind of spiritual significance, to have any kind of spiritual value attached to them, because when we do, we're bordering on saying that here's a God made with hands. And so we have to live according to that rule today, just as the Apostle Paul was teaching the people at Ephesus to live according to it during this time. So we can see the gist of this man Demetrius' argument, that because of this doctrine of Paul, then, our craft, our trade, is brought into danger. So he continues in verse 27, he says, "So that not only this our craft is in danger, to be set at naught, but also that the temple of the great goddess Diana should be despised, and her magnificence should be destroyed, whom all Asia and the world worshipeth." So he gives a twofold argument against this doctrine that Paul taught. The first one is that our craft is in danger, to be set at naught. The way we make a living is in jeopardy here. And really how much in jeopardy it was, we do not know. But just the very thought that if everybody believed like Paul is teaching, we would no longer have a job, that was enough to be frightening to them. And we have to realize that the very same thing is true today. If everyone today believed the same way that Paul taught, there'd be no jobs creating these little images. Nobody would have a job doing that, because it would put everybody out of business who makes any kind of a trinket or image that is given any kind of special religious significance or spiritual significance or spiritual power. It would put everybody out of business doing that, because the doctrine that Paul taught was opposed to that. And so that was the first argument that he made. But the second one is, and this is the one designed to really appeal to the emotions of anybody, he says also that the temple of the great goddess Diana should be despised, and her magnificence should be destroyed. Now we have to realize that this great temple was a magnificent edifice. It was at that time one of the seven wonders of the world. Originally, the goddess Diana was a small wooden statue. We don't know what kind of wood it was, but it was a small wooden statue, and this is way back centuries before Christ. And then eventually, when that became decayed by age, it was propped up by two rods of iron, like spits, which were carefully copied in the image that was afterward made in the imitation of the first image. And then a temple was made. A very magnificent temple was built to contain this image of Diana. But this temple was built several times, and it was rebuilt because it was destroyed many times. It seems that the first one was built at about 570 B.C., 570 years before Christ. And then another one is mentioned at 540 years before Christ. Another one at 400 years B.C., another one at 356 B.C. And finally, this temple that was present during the days of this book of Acts, when the book of Acts was written, it was one that had been worked on for 220 years before it was completed. 220 years in the building of it. It was 425 feet long,
220 feet wide, and it was supported by 127 pillars of Parian marble, each of which was 60 feet high. Now, each of these pillars, these 127 pillars, were furnished by a different prince from around the world. The prince would contribute the money needed to put up this one pillar. Each one did. And 36 of these pillars were carved in a very special way, and the rest of them were finely polished. Each pillar is supposed, with its base, to weigh 150 tons of marble. And the doors and the paneling were made of cypress wood. The roof was made of cedar. The interior was decorated with gold, and it was finished by the very finest production of the ancient artists. So we see then a very great structure here, this temple of the goddess of Diana. He says that we're afraid that it'll be despised and her magnificence should be destroyed. Well, of course, it had been destroyed many times in the past, and it eventually was destroyed again. We don't know just exactly when this happened, but after various partial demolitions, it was finally burned by the Goths in their third naval invasion in A.D. 260. And now there's not even any place left where you can even really know for sure where the site of this temple was. So it really was destroyed. But that's the expression of fear that Demetrius gives as he talks in his speech before this mob of people. And so he's afraid that the temple is going to be despised, or magnificence should be destroyed. He says, whom all Asia and the world worshipeth. Now this was a true statement. This was the major god of this part of the world, and of course in other parts of the world it was still recognized as being one of the major gods of the world. People came from all parts of the world to worship this goddess of Diana. They came just to see this temple. They made special tours to be able to see and visit the temple. And of course when they did, the people who made these little shrines, who made these replicas of the temple, they would sell more and more of their productions, and it meant more money for them. So you can see then how this would be an emotionally charged issue. It's something that would be easy to get a mob up about. The people could become very disturbed about it, because not only is our religion put in jeopardy, but our way of making a living is put in jeopardy here. And so you see the picture then, this great mob of people all stirred about their religion and about their way of making a living, which are two of the closest things that anybody has strong feeling for, and these things seem to be in jeopardy. At least the way Demetrius presented it was in jeopardy. Verse 28 says, and when they heard these things, they were full of wrath and cried out, saying, great is Diana of the Ephesians. So they were full of wrath. They were full of anger. This was a very emotionally charged issue. It wasn't something that they sat down and gave some calm, cool, calculated reasoning about, but they were working on wrath now. And any time a person acts as a result of anger, as a result of wrath, he's going to do some very rash things. He's going to do some things that he wished he hadn't done later even. And so they cried out saying, great is Diana of the Ephesians. Whatever anybody wanted to say, whatever kind of reasoning power anybody might have, they couldn't get past this very high, emotionally charged cry, great is Diana of the Ephesians. They would not hear anything different from this. Verse 29 says, and the whole city was filled with confusion. So this tumult, this mob action, had reached such proportions that now that all the city was involved in it. Everybody knew that something was going on. They didn't know just what. It was filled with confusion. And he further says, and having caught Gaius and Aristarchus, men of Macedonia, Paul's companions in travel, they rushed with one accord into the theater. Now, Gaius, of course, was the person that lived at Corinth. Paul says in writing to the Corinthians that he was one of the two that he baptized, and he had Paul to stay at his house, actually. Aristarchus was one who attended Paul to Rome, and was there a prisoner with him in Rome, according to Colossians 4 and 10. So these are two close companions of Paul. They're traveling companions of Paul. And so since they evidently didn't know where Paul was at this time, they got the thing that was the nearest to Paul, his two close companions, Gaius and Aristarchus, and they rushed with one accord into the theater. Now the theater was among the Greeks, it was a place for public exhibitions. It was also a place for holding assemblies and often used for courts, elections, etc. And so the people naturally, therefore, rushed there since it was a suitable place to decide this great matter that was at hand. And verse 30 says, "And when Paul would have entered in unto the people, the disciples suffered him not." Now, Paul was willing to go and face this mob and make his defense. He was willing to go and state his self in person how he felt about this and defend himself to whatever best way that he could, but the disciples wouldn't let him go. The disciples felt like this was poor judgment. This was not a time to heap coals on the fire. This was not a time for Paul to get mixed into this mob like this, because they felt that no good could come of it. And even verse 31 says, "And certain of the chief of Asia, which were his friends." Now, the chief of Asia would have to be some persons who were in a high position among the people. They were elected officials of some kind, probably, and they were the friends of Paul. It doesn't mean that they were Christian converts. It doesn't mean that they believed the gospel that Paul taught. But it probably means that they had feelings of respect towards him and were disposed to defend him in his cause. They wanted Paul to have a right to teach the things that he believed, and they realized that Paul was not trying to undermine the religion nor the way of making a living that these people had. He wasn't going to be able to convert everybody. He wasn't going to be able to change all Asia. The history of the true church shows that that's never been the case. But at any rate, these people were his friends, and so they were desiring him that he would not adventure himself into the theater. So Paul had a lot of pressure from several sides now, trying to discourage him from going into the theater and among that mob, his own disciples, and these certain of the chief of Asia even, the people who were officials. They could read the minds of the mob. They knew what was going on, and they knew from experience that this was not the place for Paul to be. So Luke continues, verse 32, "Some therefore cried one thing, and some another, for the assembly was confused." Now, as is true of most mobs, everybody there didn't even know what they were there for. They were just there because there was a group of people come together, and they were there out of curiosity. And they were crying this and crying that, but they didn't really know what the purpose of the assembly was. Most of them didn't. The assembly was confused, "and the more part knew not wherefore they were come together." Now, there was a hardcore that did know why they came together. They were there for the purpose of trying to defend their ability to make a living by selling these goddesses, these idolatrous images. But most of the people were just there out of curiosity, and they didn't even know what they were there for. Verse 33, "And they drew Alexander out of the multitude." Now, we do not know exactly who this Alexander is. Some think that this was Alexander the coppersmith, who had in some way done Paul much harm, according to 2 Timothy 4 and 14. This was also the same Alexander with whom, with Philetus, Paul had to withdraw fellowship from. But some of them suppose that this Alexander was the one that was put forth, and that the Jews were putting him up there to show that here's one who had been a member of the Christian party, and he now was no longer following along with the Christians, and so he could further blame Paul with trying to undermine the way that these people had of making a living. But it's not clear that this was the Alexander that Paul had withdrawn from. It's not clear that this is the Alexander talking of in 2 Timothy 4 and 14. It could have been another Alexander, just a Jew who was trying to defend the Jews from this multitude and to show that the Jews had no part of this. It's easy for us to see how that the Jews could be drawn into it, because the Christians really were looked upon as just being a sect of the Jews. These people were really very close to the Jews, and they're just a little bit different from them, and had kind of pulled off from the Jews, started their own religion, but really what they believed, the Jews also believed. And so the Jews were putting up this man to defend themselves and say, "We're having no part of this. We're not to blame for this, and do not accuse the Jews for being a part of this matter." And actually, of course, the Jews believed exactly the same doctrine that Paul taught. They believed that there would be no gods made with hands. All the Old Testament is full of teaching against idolatry and against the making of images. But the Jews still wanted to put themselves out of this limelight and let it be squarely upon those who were referred to as Christians. So they put this man Alexander forward, and Alexander beckoned with the hand and would have made his defense unto the people, but when they knew that he was a Jew, all with one voice, about the space of 2 hours, cried out, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians." Once they found out he was a Jew, they wouldn't let him talk. There was a natural hatred, it seems, of the Jewish people. There was an inborn prejudice against the Jews. And so he wasn't even allowed to make any kind of a defense. When they saw that here was a Jew about to speak to us, we don't want to hear what he has to say. And we're not going to listen to him. We're not going to let him talk. And so Luke says they cried out about the space of 2 hours, which is a long time for a mob to cry and to be out of control and to not have anyone to be able to address them. They cried out, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians." That was their cry. That was their crowning statement to make to try to defend everything they did. "Great is Diana of the Ephesians." And of course, when you have mob action going, it doesn't take very much to justify anything the mob wants to do. If we can cry loud enough that Diana is great, if we can cry loud enough that she is truly a god and that she truly should be worshipped, then this makes it so. This makes it so much a fact that then anything we do toward that end is justified. And so you can see how dangerous a mob is. They could put somebody to death. They could stone someone. They could hang someone. They could just about do anything that is feasible to be done, because mob action doesn't have to have any good reason or rationale for why it does anything. Well, you can see then that this whole city now was in a tumult. Everything is out of control with this great mob. So verse 35 says, "And when the town clerk had appeased the people, he said..." Now, the town clerk was some kind of a scribe. He was some kind of an official of the city. We don't know exactly what his position was, but he was probably one that had to do with the public notaries, some kind of a clerk. But he was in a position of high enough authority that he was able to get the attention of this multitude. They had some kind of respect for him. They had some kind of feeling that here was a man of authority. And so when he'd appeased the people, that is, had restrained them, he quieted them, he tranquilized them so as to be able to talk to them. He got them calmed down enough so that they were now listening. And so then he makes a little speech here to the mob to attempt to calm them down and to get them to be more reasoning and to have a rational approach to this matter. And he begins his speech by saying, "Ye men of Ephesus, what man is there that knoweth not how that the city of the Ephesians is a worshipper of the great goddess Diana and of the image which fell down from Jupiter?" Now, he explains that it's a well-known fact that this city of Ephesus is given over to the worship of this goddess of Diana. Our worship, our belief, our religion is in no danger at all. The world hasn't turned against Diana. And this word here for worshiper of the great goddess really means a temple keeper. We're known as the city that keeps the temple of this great goddess. However much this goddess may be recognized in the rest of the world, this is the city that keeps the temple. This is a well-known fact. We haven't changed in that at all. And he further says, "And of the image which fell down from Jupiter." Now, the feeling was that this original image of Diana had actually fallen down from heaven, fallen down from Jupiter. And it was a common belief during this day for many cities to believe that their god, their idol, or their idols had actually fallen from heaven. And so they believe this about Diana. And he is reaffirming the fact that this is the true God that we're following here. This is Diana. This image actually came from heaven, and the world recognizes this, and we as a city are the keeper of the temple. And so he says in verse 3, "Seeing then that these things cannot be spoken against, you ought to be quiet and to do nothing rashly." He says, actually, these things are not going to be able to be spoken against. Nobody can really turn the world away from this practice that we have here. It is so great. It is so overwhelming. It is so widely accepted. It is so popular that nobody can really speak against this. And so you don't have anything to worry about. You don't have to fear. So he says you ought to be quiet and to do nothing rashly. You're going to do more harm than you're good by having a mob like this, to having a tumultuous action, because actually your fears are unfounded. This is such a great sweeping movement, this worship of the goddess of Diana, that no one's going to be able to really speak against it and to be effective. And he says in verse 37, "For ye have brought hither these men, which are neither robbers of churches, nor yet blasphemers of your goddess." These men that you brought here, and he's probably talking about Gaius and Aristarchus, the ones that they had seized and brought into this meeting place. He says, they're not robbers of churches, nor blasphemers of your goddess. They have done nothing to physically attack this temple. They've done nothing to deface the goddess. They've done nothing to cause any kind of a danger or a threat. They've even made no threats against it. It's just as safe now as it ever was. And not only that, but they're not blasphemers of your goddess. They taught against idolatry, sure, but they didn't have to blaspheme Diana. It was just a matter of once you saw the truth about idolatry, you put two and two together and could see that this included Diana. It included all the idols, but they didn't have to blaspheme Diana to do this. And that's an interesting thing about the way that the gospel was taught at that particular place. It wasn't taught in an offensive manner. It wasn't taught in a manner to inflame someone, but the truth was taught and stayed with. And then once you saw what the truth was, you evidently could easily see that this included all idolatry, even Diana. But this particular goddess wasn't blasphemed, nor yet was the temple robbed or defaced or even threatened with any kind of violence. And that's the argument that now that this town clerk makes to this mob as he tries to calm them down. And we're going to have to stop at that point right in the midst of his speech to them. But next time we'll continue with what he says to calm this mob down. Until next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.
Sunset and evening star, and one clear call for me. And may there be no moaning of the bar when I put out to sea. But such a tide as moving seems asleep, too full for sound and foam, when that which drew from out the boundless deep turns again home, turns home. Twilight and evening bell, and after that the dark, and may there be no sadness of farewell when I embark. For though from out our bourne of time and place, the flood may bear me far, I hope to see my pilot face to face.
we are in him. So we're told here very plainly that the gauge to go by to determine if we truly love him, if we're truly accepted by him, is whether or not we keep his commandments. Well, we have to first of all know what those commandments are,